Can I bring something back to Full Metal Jacket real quick?
Sure.
This whole idea of experiencing it first through TV, through a virtual reality kind of training wheels type of environment. That mm-hmm. first firefight that the soldiers are involved in Full Metal Jacket, you have all the new soldiers in a bunker with all this firepower, and this rinky-dink truck and these half-ass soldiers bum-rush the base, right?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem to my logic that that was a good battle plan for any human being. Like, you're supposed to assume because they're Vietnamese and because you don't know who they are that they would actually conceive in their brain that we're going to go attack this base and we're going to go fuck those Americans up. It's absurd, the decision of those people to attempt to even approach that base. It's almost as if it was a way for them to pop their cherry with some drugged up Vietnamese prostitute that from afar you'll get your first kill. From afar, you'll be able to shoot your first gun at real human beings, and that first seed of experience will be given to you so that when you are in that real room with that real human being, you'll be able to pull the trigger because you'll think, I've done this before. And to me, it was almost as if, you know, certain people were paid off to go on a suicide mission. Like, I can believe that. But I can't believe that those people were really part of some army and that that was their battle plan.
Well, I look at it, it's actually, the imagery is very similar to that Forbidden Planet where they're trying to hold the gate against the monster from the id. The way it plays out is it's sort of like just this one opening. You sort of have the two walled off, and then there's just that like one sort of gate. And if you look at the imagery, I'd actually like to put those two screenshots side to side, but having looked at the Forbidden Planet clip very recently, it's actually incredibly similar. This sort of like that, this almost the same distance from the camera, that same sort of focal point where the barriers meet. So to me, it's this idea of, again, like this the fear of the alien other, this sort of, you know, mysterious jungle spirit coming in, that you're in this sort of camp. But I definitely see where you're going with that. Can I quickly throw this back just to Tim Allen 1 second? Is to say, just at like the, oh God, I don't know, like the week of 9/11, Tim Allen's movie Big Trouble comes out. Now, I remember I had read the book Big Trouble, so I was one of the few people who actually wanted to see this movie. Because it's actually a really good book. But Tim Allen, they actually end up like postponing it in the theaters. It was this whole big like kind of like kerfuffle because Tim Allen, in that movie, they sneak a bomb onto a plane and they show how easy it is to get past the TSA. And they sneak a nuclear bomb onto a plane and the plane explodes. And then they thought that was too close to 9/11 that they didn't want to really show it or market it. I remember going to see it in the theaters, and there was literally, you know, like you go and like over the thing, there's like some fancy, you know, board from the movie company, like, you know, like with their font, their logo, a picture of the actors. For Big Trouble, like all the other ones looked at that. For Big Trouble, there was literally like a piece of paper that said Big Trouble taped there. And it was this thing that the film company pulled all their marketing. They had actually already spent all their marketing to advertise the movie, but then when they delayed it, they had no marketing money left. So when I went to the theater, it was like just a piece of paper taped to the board that said Big Trouble.
Weird. It's with Rene Russo.
Mm-hmm.
I'm constantly on alert for RRs. I've been on a whole thing on Road Runner, Red Rum, Rock and Roll, Rest and Relaxation, obviously. It was like there's a lot. Basically, I've been going through and Robbie the Robot,
Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan. Yeah, just for days. And so Rene Russo is a new one. Randy the Ram from The Wrestler, the Darren Aronofsky film, watched the other night. I've seen it before. It's one of my fucking absolute favorites. I don't know if you guys have seen that.
Great movie.
I've actually never seen it, now.
So there's all this whole thing where it's the ram, and he's a sacrificial ram, and he's a wrestler, and it's just totally, it's totally perfect. But I like that Roadrunner is in The Shining, you know.
That's right.
You watch Roadrunner and then The Red Rum, and so it's R&R. And then if you watch Apocalypse Now in the first scene after they play the end, which is what I put in with The Shining, that was one of my favorite things. As far as music and film goes, that I've ever found, that the timing wasn't arbitrary too. I played three albums before it. That was the second at which it ended. I put on the end, and then it ends at the same exact moment that Jack dies. But anyways, they play the end on Apocalypse Now, and then right afterwards, he said he's in Shanghai getting some R&R, and then fucking punches the mirror, and he's wiping the blood all over his hand, and then the end comes on again, you know. But just, I don't know, I've been, and then Red Rum with the fucking blood, it's just totally, like, I see a correlation there. Also, something that's been coming up repeatedly that I was talking with William about is the horror of Babylon, and how she keeps showing up, and how the end of Apocalypse Now says the horror, you know, and all the implications of that as far as all the things I've been looking at with the Babylonian squares and how that's the foundation for this whole fucking country. As when we mapped out the whole East Coast, we did it according to these Babylonian squares, which is really weird because those squares, it's one laid in the other. You have the sun and then you have Mars and you have Saturn, or Mars is at the top, but they all meet at 13. And 13 is the goddess, the Venus, the Shekinah, and they all depend on her. And it's where we get the imagery of the Tower of Babel, is from the overlay of the Babylonian squares, because you basically, they're meant to be folded like a cylinder, and you end up with these steps. And the steps are supposed to, it's also where we get Stairway to Heaven and Jacob's Ladder. Like, that totally ties in. And it's totally just a mathematical code, and we used it to build this whole country, Masons did, way back when. And it's very possible that the UK is places are done the same way, and the big cities, you know, like the Vatican and shit. So anyways, whatever, I was just tripping out on how everything depends upon the goddess, and that they basically are taking energy and utilizing war as a means to expand, but they're building a tower that they know will collapse. It's a mandala. You know, you put all this work into something willingly, knowing that the thing isn't going to endure, but you do it anyway because it's what we do, you know? So,
that's what I've been working on. I've been working on a book trying to show how that is over and over and over again. And I think it comes down to one of the most basic sort of elements of human life on this planet is, you know, it is sex, and that sex and death is that basically the tower is the masculine. You know, you have your phallus that you're building this sort of egoic architecture, this structure, and you build your tower, and, you know, this proud masculine tower, and then you enter the feminine void, and then after you ejaculate, that tower collapses.
And
So it's like the masculine rises up, the feminine is the void that sort of absorbs it, and then the tower falls back down, and we're constantly sort of building our tower to our goddess. It seems pretty explicit what that's sort of symbolizing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well put. That's a huge thing in psychology, and that's Wilhelm Reich, you know, and from student of Freud and Jung's and everything, you know, he was also in the same place where Burroughs is talking about Crowley. He's bringing in Wilhelm Reich's idea of the orgone energy. It's a huge thing in psychology, is that the death instinct and the sex instinct are more than just intimately connected. They're the same thing. The movement towards the death, and that's like the small death. The orgasm is a small death, and we're basically it's our attempt to our relationship to that, at least, not that itself, but how we relate to that tends to be, you know, they mirror each other. You know, so you're basically, how would you say? It's like a coping mechanism to die before you die. Exactly. But it's a substitute self that dies. It's not actually you.
No, it's pure ego death. I mean, I don't know. I'd actually, I don't know if this is a really personal question, but I don't mind saying it. But I equate, you know, a sort of psychedelic ego death or a sexual petite mort, the small death, is very similar. I know that after sex, after an orgasm, my mind drifts, and it's the, you know, not only is it, of course, you have all the endorphins and whatever, but I find that some of the most, the biggest revelations in my life come within minutes after orgasm.
Come. Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't resonate more, sir.
Well, yeah. For me, I haven't been sexually active in a while. And, you know, I have to find other alternative methods to get into that state. So, although nice, I find for me in my work, a relationship is too much of a drag. And that might just speak to the quality of the relationships that I've had.
Well, that's a good thing for you because that's sublimation. I mean, all this work that we're doing here, like fucking all of it, is sublimation and to one degree or another. And the more that you're able to focus that energy, there's only one energy, you know, that's the deal. You know, we use it in different ways, you know, in different directions. And so, yeah, sublimation.
Like, so like for me, I just recently did that 10-day fast, the Master Cleanse, where you just drink lemonade, maple syrup, cayenne pepper, and water for 10 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did it with honey. But yeah.
And the illumination, how long of an extended illumination I had during periods of that 10 days was astronomical.
Mm-hmm.
Astronomical. You know, one day I went on an extended walk for the first time in a cemetery during the day. Mm-hmm. And I went to the cemetery and discovered this place in my neighborhood that I had never gone into. And I crossed the street into this park that had a 16-inch softball Hall of Fame. And it was like a cemetery itself because they had all these placards of different softball players in the city of Chicago. And I was thinking about my own father and just meditating upon death and my father and what you leave behind. And then within the next 5 hours after that experience, two different people that I met told me that their father died.
Mm.
And I mean, it was just like, and one of them was completely random. I was walking around the neighborhood and I ran into a customer at my bar. Hey, how you doing? Oh, you know, things have been better. My father died. Then I go to my bar where I work at a few hours later, and a guy named Bill tells me that his father just died. I mean, it was just like surreal how what it is, this sink field that we try to get into, I just busted open completely. But I was using this – there's a certain death instinct to fasting where you say, I'm not going to eat food for 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you throw yourself into a an underworld of where you are literally under this usual world where you are not allowed to touch the things that you usually have. So, you know, the sex death instinct, you know, for me, I think the whole advice of these magicians are utilizing alternative ways to get to the same place. And is that something you'd agree with?
Absolutely, yeah.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I mean, this is a really complicated subject because there's it's not as straightforward as I think we would like it to be. There's the argument that originally the old church, where people set up their own rules in the first place, where they weren't being conditioned, and certain sects of the church, this happened, you know, where it wasn't like as dogmatic, but it was actually more based on reason. You know, there was this people would abstain, you know, from sex, But there was a period of time in which they did that, which was devoted to practice, and then they would return later. But there's the idea that with energy, you know, if everything goes towards the Malkuth for so long, you know, it's okay to remind yourself that this energy can move in other directions, you know, particularly to Keter, like move it through. And so I think that there's definitely something to be said for what happens when that practice gets instilled to the point where it's natural and it's not something that you're having to force, but it happens on its own almost, through a momentum of the consistency of the practice, that there's not as much to worry about. But if one hasn't experienced that, it's hard without completely removing yourself from, you know, whatever, to be able to dedicate yourself to get to that point where that's established. So the idea of establishing a practice is really key, I think, but the idea of like a dogmatic repression is something else altogether.
Yes.
Ideally, you want to be able to experience both at the same time. I know for myself, once again, this could be considered personal or whatever, but when I reach orgasm, my energy goes to my brain. You know, I feel both at the same time. It's just I get awakened energetically, and so, and that there tends to be revelations. I tend to get insights in the state, you know. But I don't know. I
You know, I go with the McKenna model, which is, you know, all of these things apply. You know, there are so many different ways to get there. Why not try, you know, a little from column A, a little from column B? And I think that there definitely does need to be a mix and see sort of how, as David said, how it goes in different directions. But, you know, that idea of at orgasm being in your head and this sort of thing, a very big realization for me a few years ago, I was in this space where I was, you know, I don't know, smoking a lot of pot and listening to a lot of George Harrison. And I got, you know, and I got into this, like, very, like, everything was, like, peaceful and trying to be, like, holy and good. And I don't know sort of where my mind went, but it was just, like, you know, a guy stole, like, $2,000 from me. And I was, like, this was a roommate of mine. I was like, well, if he needs it, you know.
And oh, wow. Hair like at this point? Was it long?
Yes, it was very long. But I was just trying to, like, everything was like, okay. You know, like just, it was a very peaceful Zen state, but ultimately very self-destructive in that, you know, so the guy steals the money and I go, well, if he needs it, that's okay. And then a few months later, I was completely broke, literally starving to death, where I was eating food with maggots in it and ended up in the hospital from malnutrition and all this stuff. So, you know, and then ultimately, like, before I got to the part where I went to the hospital for malnutrition, I suddenly one day went, wait a second, this motherfucker stole $2,000 from me. And I chased him for, like, 5 miles to literally beat the fuck out of him to get my money. Like, I just, like, something flipped of, like, uh-uh, it's not okay to just let it go.
That's a pendulum swing,
yeah. I mean, you know, I think this was a big learning experience for me. But this was probably like around like 2004 or 5. And, you know, really big learning experience for me. But anyway, I mean, something, so like at that time, even like from a sexual standpoint, this idea of like, you know, trying to be pure, and then like I was finding this hard way of like trying to figure out how to coincide those two ideas of, well, I'm just trying, and everything's like, oh, focus on this higher ideal, and then, you know, it was like, but I'm still a sexual creature and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, at some point I realized, I remember very specifically, like, one night just thinking, like, this girl wanted to have sex, and I'm sitting there, and I'm like, well, I don't know, kind of in this other place right now, you know, and I don't really think in terms of like God and devil is a literal thing, so I just want to sort of put that out there. But the realization was, you know, my head, like pointing to my head, and I was like, this is for God, and pointing to my dick and saying, this is for the devil. And they both need what they need. And sort of went into the experience with this sort of dual-headed mindset, if you will, of like being both at once, where I was allowing myself to be the animal and allowing myself to be this higher consciousness. And what I found is it actually balanced me, and of course that balancing meets in the heart. And it was one of my first, like, I guess we'd consider it like a yogic realization of finding that very intimate balance.
Yeah, you should rewrite the saying from Metropolis. What is it? The mediator between the head and the dick is the heart.
Exactly.
Cool.
Sorry, I didn't mean this is taking a strange turn, but just to say that I think there is room for all of these things, these different energetic explorations, and for me, since then, the answer has been finding balance, where you don't deny one or the other expression. So,
well, what's the legend of the King Wen I Ching sequence? Do you know that story?
Yeah.
That he was imprisoned, and that he devised the I Ching sequence as a way to keep in touch with the universe outside.
Oh, that's... I thought he developed it with his son. Was his son also in prison with him?
You know, I'm just going by the story I heard from McKenna.
Okay.
So he might change the story to further different dialogues, which I'm completely cool with. But the story I always kept with me was that he was imprisoned and he wanted to know what was going on in the kingdom, but he couldn't see it because he was in this cell. So he developed this I Ching sequence, which I've equated as the first computer program. And almost literally the first computer. It's just a two-dimensional computer. And that through the construction of that, it was the first broadcast of the DNA, the clear white light projecting itself through the prism of his body, and then you had this rainbow of refraction. And so he, in prison, was able to transmit that code, which fell down through the ages and somehow landed into all the different places that it manifests itself. So, you know, I wonder how much credence is to that legend or why that story is told that way.
Do you think, Bill, that him being sort of in prison, you know, this goes to that same idea of he's probably not eating well, he's probably not having sex, he's not really connected, so he is connecting in other ways? Is that sort of...
He's relying on different parts of his neocortex that he never had to rely on because, you know, the whole thing with Crowley and the breaks, meditation, you count how many breaks you have during a meditation. And the goal is to go through an extended period of time without breaking.
Mm-hmm.
So death would be the ultimate break. Sex would be the tiny break, unless done through a heightened, energized enthusiasm, tantric sort of way where you can transcend the break and go into that longer uninterrupted space. But where the king, who, if you're a king, you know, you have the finest food, the finest harem, the finest of all these things that break. And if he was imprisoned, all of a sudden he can't break his consciousness like that. He's thrust into a period where he has to deal with abstention of all that, and then out of that manifested this code.
Mm-hmm.
Just out of pure survival. And so, you know, it's a poetic story for someone like me with the kind of work that I'm doing currently, so I can really attract myself to that and say, yeah, this is it. But really, you know, I just say it's just one perspective on it.
Mm-hmm. I got a friend who just called me from prison, from Folsom Prison. He's a really good friend who is in prison for murder. It wasn't premeditated, and it's a long story, and I had to go through the whole court thing with him. I was asked to testify, but I didn't want to, and I'm glad I didn't when I saw what happened to my friends who did testify. But he called me. Someone gave him a fucking cell phone, and he called me from his cell, and we talked for like 3 hours. He woke me up the other morning, and he's like in there studying fucking physics like crazy, and his mind is like, he's a really fucking smart guy in the first place, but he's like reading David Bohm and looking at all this stuff. It was just like, it was intense to hear him, because I mean, I know he's not eating well because they don't give you fucking good food in prison, you know, but he works out constantly. He's like fucking weighs like twice as much as he did before because of muscle mass. And he didn't used to look like a criminal, but I'm sure he does now. I mean, even when I saw him in the courtroom after he had been in jail for a year, he looked a whole lot different, you know. But anyways, whatever, you know, it's just, it reminded me of it. It was interesting.
To me, it seems like it's the same thing as the military boot camp from Full Metal Jacket. You know, it's the prison system literally is turning people, if not into a more criminal, at least certainly appearance and behavior that, you know, polite society considers criminal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sad.
Yeah. Well, you know, the whole Gnostic thing of the Black Iron Prison, you know, it's a thought structure to get you to transcend your animal consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. It wants you to find a way to escape.
Right.
But yet, you look at Full Metal Jacket, and you have a country of people who have gotten comfortable within the Black Iron Prison. Mm-hmm. That they said, all right, fuck it. It's a prison, but you know what? I got McDonald's, TV, and a wife and kids, and I'm cool. And a Full Metal Jacket is sort of saying, all right, the Black Iron Prison, you're content to just be a prisoner. Well, we're going to turn it into something you wear now. We're going to actually affix it to your body. So the Black Iron Prison becomes the Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah, it's like Man in the Iron Mask, but instead it's like the body, it's like the straitjacket almost.
Yeah, so the only person who made the rational decision was, or you could debate it, but, you know, Pyle found a way out to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
Necessarily healthy, but it might be a healthy decision or a healthy reaction.
Could I just, you just made me realize what I was saying before. This is my rifle, this is my gun, this is for fighting, this is for
fun. This is for fun.
When I was saying, this is for God, this is devil.
Yeah.
This is for fighting, this is for fun.
And then named the rifle after, give it a woman's name, Charlene. That was Pyle's gun name. Charlene. But, you know, one of the few things in Full Metal Jacket that was, like, you know, outright, as far as Kubrick is concerned, in the subtext is the Jungian thing. In the first place, Born to Kill and a peace symbol. You wear a peace symbol and you have Born to Kill on your helmet. What, could you pull your head out of your ass or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. And whose side are you on? Anyways, and he's like, I think I was trying to say something about the, the human condition. He says the Jungian thing, sir. But the whole thing is, throughout the movie, you never see the Viet Cong. You see them in the shadows, or you see them dead. They're like ghosts until the very end when they get the assassin, and it's a woman, you know? It's like, we have seen the enemy and it is ourselves is the thing in the film. And he says, you know, I think we might be shooting the wrong gooks, but maybe they mean the film, that they're filming the film and they're shooting, like you're shooting a film and it's them.
Well, the whole film crew there in the war, I mean, you know, I don't know the history of the Vietnam War very well at all. But if I'm going to trust good old Uncle Stanley to tell me the story for me so I can save a little time, if anything, what that picture of war was, it was just a destruction mission. It was just industry was forming in a section of marketable land. Buildings, factories were being built, but they weren't American factories. So we're going to go in and destroy them so that we can build our own. And in the process, we can get these fat, sort of feminized American boys, and we're going to turn them into men. We're going to turn them into killers. And just like all the presidents leading up to 1960 fought in wars and were generals, we needed new sort of veterans to be able to lead the whole machine into the future. That's mm-hmm. what that movie told me about the Vietnam War.
Well, it's more than Vietnam. It's our own shadow. And what it's reflecting back is that we think we see ourselves, but what we see is the surface of ourselves. And they're being programmed to externalize their shadow onto an enemy that doesn't actually exist. We've seen the enemy, and it is us. The enemy is themselves, and they're fighting themselves. They're at war with themselves.
Absolutely.
And that's what's being suppressed and what comes out in a fucked up way. So the gangbang at the end is them all being like, well, as long as we're in this together, somehow it's fucking okay. Even though we're suppressing it and basically calling killing sex, it doesn't matter because we're all in agreement here. We're all on the same page. And it's like you can hold an illusion together so much better when everyone asserts the same illusion, you know?
Do you realize that the shots at the end, a lot of that stuff, I've in researching some of the Stanley Kubrick stuff, they shot like on an old, I think it was like a kind of oil field, like gas station space. And like I remember like reading, I think it was Christiane Kubrick, his wife, who was like saying how toxic it was for them to like basically even be filming on this ground. But think about what that sort of would symbolize, the idea of being on an oil field is sort of like a tar pit. It brings back to the beginning of 2001, all the apes fighting for, I think, Bill, you're the one who said this idea of going for the future technology. What is, you know, at the beginning of 2001, all those apes fighting on the tar pit to advance their technology.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Technology, what is some of the quote I read? Technology is explicitness. It's just trying to make things explicit. So there is a technology designed to make the shadow explicit, correct? I mean, that's a healthy thing.
That's literally Forbidden Planet. That's literally, there's a machine that's making all their thoughts into reality.
The Philip K. Dick novel is the exact same thing. I in the Sky or something like that, where these people are walking into realities and everything that's happening around them is just their, you know, buried unconscious manifesting itself.
Does
haven't
Philip
seen
K. Dick really have a book called Eye in the Sky?
Yes.
I beg your pardon.
It was written in like 1959, I think.
Wow. Okay. Cool. I'll look that up.
It's, 1957, Eye in the Sky.
Okay.
And, you know, you read it and you're like, God, how many different versions of this have already been made? Yeah, it's something.
You know, the idea of the LSD connection to the A-bomb being the moonchild through the Babylon working that Oppenheimer took part in, and the fact that Oppenheimer built the A-bomb the same year LSD was discovered and all of that is interesting in regard to 2001, being that Arthur C. Clarke, all his connections with NASA, particularly JPL. I don't know. I've just something to consider that also the notion of the moonchild being the star child at the end, where the star child, in a sense, could be seen as the moon looking down at the earth.
Well,
you know.
Who is the name of the ape that first picks up the bone to utilize the technology, Moonwatcher.
Oh, where is it? I got the book right here.
His name is Moonwatcher.
Moonwatcher, that's right.
So okay. The child of that moment of technological birth is the child of Moonwatcher. It's Moon's child.
Right, and this is the never-ending story. It's Moonchild. It's the Empress. And then the Empress is actually Dalit, right? The path of the Empress on the tree is actually from Hohma to Bina, in the European system at least. And she's crossed by the High Priestess from Keter to Tiferet. And so that's just, I don't know, that I found that really interesting that the Moon Child is actually between Hohma and Bina, which is, you know, wisdom and understanding. It's the balance of the scales. I don't know. I was tripping out on that.
And that would come right, if I'm trying to envision, would be right above the abyss or
right.
So yes. So once you pass the abyss, you're at the Moon Child, and literally, David Bowman, when he enters the monolith and goes into the Stargate or the abyss, that, you know, vortex, void, whatever term suits you. Mm-hmm. That's when you would then reach the Moon Child. It would literally be the right. next step.
Right, which is metal, which is echoes. So that's so perfect because the film is divided ultimately into four parts, which has been argued. But it's, you know, at this point, I guess the general consensus, because you're going from the Earth, which is Malkuth at the beginning, the dawn of man, and then you go to the Moon, which is Yesod, and then from there, you continue on the Jupiter mission. Jupiter and Saturn, that's the top of the tree, right? So you, and the lyric in Echoes is no one flies around the sun. The sun, this is all European system, being Tiferet, no one flies around Tiferet. But meanwhile, here's the on another level, they do. So it's like we might not send a fucking ship into outer space to fly around the sun, but meanwhile, we can do it on another level.
Set the controls for the heart of the sun.
Exactly.
And exactly. Even, is it Astronomy?
Domain.
Yeah, there's the line, Jupiter and Saturn.
Right, and Stairway Scare Dan, who's there? Stairway Scare Dan. It's totally. If I trip out on Danny in The Shining, leading Jack into the labyrinth, and it's like Dan's labyrinth, and as Coates points out, you flip the D and you get a P, and then you have Pan's labyrinth. So Dan's labyrinth is Pan's labyrinth, and that's the first lyrics and the first Pink Floyd song and the first Pink Floyd album is Astronomy Domain on Piper at the Gates of Dawn. Piper is Pan, you know.
Yeah.
Pan pipes, and you know, and so that was the thing that was tripping me out was that I felt that there was this suggestion of genocide, which is agreed upon by a lot of people with The Shining, you know, because there's a whole Indian thing. They built it on Indian burial ground. You had to fight off these Indian attacks. There's Indian stuff everywhere. There's an Indian Holocaust. The fucking place is built. You know, and it's like this whole thing where it connects to Poltergeist too, where Poltergeist on with the moment at which he comes out of the television, you know, the spirit, Poltergeist, mm-hmm. The TV with Carol Ann in front of it. If you look closely at the television set, it reads 2:37 is the time at which that happens.
Oh, wow.
If you look closely. And it's so perfect because that's the whole thing. He says it's not ancient Indian burial ground. They built it on a cemetery. And there's this whole notion that I see, like, in Poltergeist and The Shining, where you're like, you know, this is, well, with the Poltergeist, it's like this America. At the beginning, what do you see but the fucking, I don't know what you call that statue with all the guys holding the flag all at the same time, like they're planting the flag, like,
it's like the triumph of Iwo Jima or something.
The broadcast that they play before they used to turn off the television sets at a certain time, you know, turn off the programming. And so right before the programming turns off, you have this very patriotic thing happening, and then it's open to the spirits once the programming shuts down or whatever. But I really, like, I don't know, I was tripping out on the notion of us suppressing history or the full what's gone on in our past, and that we're built on top of that, and we build on death. And then when we ignore that, it comes out in fucked up ways. And so it seems like both The Shining and Poltergeist kind of acknowledge that same thing, and the same way, like a burial ground, you know? So.
Yeah, definitely. Now, Kubrick, have you seen Paths of Glory?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah,
yeah, that's a great.
That's the first anti-war film.
Yeah,
it's considered. Yeah.
I'm curious. It seems, I guess, what I was sort of like picturing in my mind is this idea of this. Obviously, he seems to play with, you know, on one surface level, it's just here's a guy who's anti-war and showing the sort of destruction of it all. But when you lay out that idea of the sort of building upon the graveyards, what I sort of think about is this of like, you know, you gave the idea of how the tree is fertilized by the holy shit. And like, so when we ignore all that sort of ugliness and genocide that it's built upon, and what is, when, you know, even this idea of like the different paths of the tree, what is the paths of glory? You know, this idea of you're tracing the paths of the tree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no, that's
perspective.
Great.
There's a certain perspective that allows us to see the paths upon the tree. Like, how many millions of human lives did it take before we could have the kind of perspective that we have to see the paths on the tree? Because everything before then was existence within these individual paths, right? So it goes back to that whole Pac-Man Shining thing.
Yes.
Jack lives life from a third-person perspective, overviewing the whole thing. And he sees life as this manipulation of this game board. Whereas Danny is living within the game. The generals in Paths of Glory see it as that big map on that table, and they just move their little pieces, and someone will win and someone will lose. But who's the actor? It's
Michael Douglas?
George C. Scott.
Oh,
right?
Oh, Kirk Douglas, actually.
Kirk Douglas, rather, yeah.
Kirk Douglas. He is going from the position of seeing the game board, but then going in the game. And he's trying to tell them, your game is bullshit.
This yeah, is... and as they walk through those, you know, the no man's land, those ditches, it literally is just like the labyrinth in The Shining. There,
mm-hmm.
So that's what I was thinking, that Pac-Man, when they're in the actual, in the shit, if you will.
In the shit.
When they're in the shit, it's all from that first-person perspective of these high walls, you're walking through the labyrinth, and then, like you said, the general or Jack can see it from above. It was exactly where my mind went when you started the Pac-Man thing. Absolutely.
Totally.
And isn't that what the more cosmic underworld of extreme psychedelic experiences that most people call a bad trip? They're not dancing on top of the game board. They're in the board. You know, they're in the movie Labyrinth where, you know, the little critters start coming out of the walls. Right?
Yeah.
Did you guys see that when Roger Waters did the Wall tour? I don't know if you guys got to see that, but
I did. I was very lucky. It was amazing.
That was fucking amazing. So, but the very beginning, I don't know if he did this everywhere, but they started out with I Am Spartacus. And it was like, they played the sample, and you hear it. It's the first thing you hear. And they're like, who's Spartacus? You know, and the whole thing of we'll be crucified and all this stuff. And then all the slaves say, I Am Spartacus, I Am Spartacus. And then they throw the fucking doll from the wall, the like fucked up thing with the fucked up eyes, you know, like the dead thing, and they throw it on the stage and they flash the light on it and say, I Am Spartacus, and it's pink, you know. But I me and Amy got tickets to that, and it was great. It was like we were at Burning Man, and I was throwing shit in this fire from taking apart this stage, and the guy I was standing with was like, oh yeah, by the way, I got some extra tickets to fucking see Roger Waters do the Wall. And I was like, okay. And we went to go see it. But then shortly afterwards, we went to move Amy from San Francisco. I'd been visiting her for over a year. she lived in San Francisco, I lived in Santa Cruz, it's like a couple hours away. I go every weekend for like a year to go see her. And the day that we pack up the last of her shit in a U-Haul to leave, and she lived on the corner of Market and Castro, in the Castro, and I'm there on the street with the fucking U-Haul, and all of a sudden a fucking limousine pulls up, and Kirk Douglas gets out, and there's maybe like 20 people around, and I look up, and they're doing a showing of Spartacus. And fuck, he showed up for the showing. Jeez. And we're just about to leave in like 5 minutes. And Amy's upstairs doing some shit in her apartment just before we leave. And I see him get out, and I'm fucking like, and there's just like, and I'm just like within, like right across the street. And I just shout out at him. I'm like, I am Spartacus! As loud as I fucking could. And he turned around, and everyone turned around. I was just like standing there by the U-Haul and smiled. And it was great. I don't know how often he gets that, but I just felt like I didn't tell him that I was Spartacus.
In Spartacus, he's in the Colosseum Games, and he's trying to escape the game.
Mm-hmm. Zion, the new fucking Olympics, you know, you arrange the letters, and it's Zion. Zion point is the 0 point. It is the beyond the infinite point.
Right.
Huge.
Yeah. Huh.